Chapter 45. Neil came around to blinding light, his body seizing up despite himself. His throat was dry and sore, and he had no idea how long he'd been asleep. He did, at least, remember where he was and how he'd gotten here. That allowed him to draw in a deep breath and blow it out, blinking the dazing light from his eyes until he could make out the window and the man sitting in front of it. "Technically, you broke the terms of your bail, by the way," Browning said, without looking up from the folder he was scribbling in. He looked like he'd been awake for days, but his suit was neatly pressed. "Next time I'll tell my kidnappers I'm not allowed to cross state lines without my lawyer," Neil said, his voice hoarse. He'd never been in a hospital in his life, so he'd been surprised by just how unbothered the staff seemed over his injuries and his escort of armed cops. He would have thought they got torture victims every day from the brisk way they'd checked his back and the wound on his throat. His hand hadn't been quite so simple. Neil had still refused to look at it, but had consented to the plastic surgeon doing whatever was needed to make it. They couldn't make it functional, because that wasn't possible. So, to make it as good as it could be. They didn't put him under, just sedated him before they numbed his hand. At some point, that had turned into real sleep, with only a few moments of hazy wakefulness as all those hours awake caught up to him at once. He must have been out for a while. Browning looked like he'd had some time to get settled. Neil stretched a little, feeling the pull of it underneath whatever painkillers he'd been given. "Is watching me sleep entertaining?" he asked, rolling onto his back. He was a mess, but here in a clean and comfortable hospital bed with all of his hurts faded into nothing, it was easy to pretend he was okay. Browning finally looked up from the folder to shoot him a dry look. "I've been a little busy dealing with your trail of blood and destruction, but I'm sure it's just scintillating." "Not my trail," Neil pointed out. "No," Browning said in agreement. "We got to Machio and both of the Malcolms alive, and your buddies back home handed Plank over to the cops down there, minus a few teeth." Neil could have laughed, though it might have come out sounding hysterical. "Andrew, your testimony could be what ensures that all of them spend the rest of their lives in prison," Browning went on. "But you have to live long enough to make it to the witness stand. Once the doctors agree you can be discharged, you're going to tell us everything you know. Then we'll organize protection for you somewhere that no one will be able to find you." "No," Neil said. That word was starting to taste familiar. Browning raised an eyebrow. "No?" "I'll tell you everything you want to know. I already said that I would," Neil replied. "But I won't go into hiding." "Where do you think you're going to go? Back to school like nothing ever happened?" "Actually, yes." Since he'd spoken to Andrew on the phone, Neil hadn't considered any other option. Browning sat back in his chair. "You being there is an immediate danger to everyone on that team. Not to mention that you're a scholarship athlete with an injury that may end your career, never mind your season, if the school even lets you come back in the first place." "I didn't realize the Palmetto board had elected you their speaker," Neil replied dryly. "You worry about my father's people. I'll worry about myself." "I can't force you to do anything," Browning responded. "But I can tell you my opinion. You're being an idiot." "I'll take that under advisement," Neil said. "How long until I can leave?" "Thanks for proving my point," Browning said. "But despite the fact that you left half your blood in a warehouse a state over, they should let you out either this afternoon or tomorrow morning." "Great," Neil said, mostly meaning it, while he wondered how he was going to get in touch with the Foxes. "Where are my clothes?" "In an evidence bag," Browning replied. He tossed a plastic bag onto the bed by Neil's hip. "What was in your pockets? That you can keep." "You went through my phone?" Neil knew Browning would have, if he were any good at his job. All he would have found was contact details for Betsy, Neil's own phone, himself, and a number that Ichiro would have doubtlessly scoured from existence by now. Browning nodded. Neil pressed. "And you didn't want it as evidence?" The agent's eyes flickered distinctly to the side as he replied, "We don't need it." Which answered one of Neil's final questions. "If you knew where I was between the warehouse and the park, why bother asking?" "I have no idea what you're talking about." Browning was a terrible liar. He could have learnt something from the foxes. There was no way Stuart and his people could have made it into the country without anyone being aware of it. They were no less well-known on the international crime circuit than Nathan himself. That they would book tickets, even using falsified documents, to come out here just as Nathan was released would have seemed like a hell of a coincidence to whoever checked out red flags in the TSA computer systems. So maybe not stopping them had been a quick and easy way to solve a problem. Or maybe that hadn't been the way it happened. Maybe Stuart had made his own offer to rid the FBI of the butcher, and they'd accepted it. Okay, Neil said, because he owed his life to the fact that Stuart had been there, however that had happened. He rolled back onto his side, content to wait until someone appeared to let him out of here. He curled the bag with the phone inside it into the curve of his body. There's one thing I want to ask now, Browning said, over the rustle of sheets and plastic. Your mother. She's dead, Neil said, going still. You're sure? The implication that she would have left Neil and run if she was alive burned, but it wasn't as though Browning knew she'd run in the first place to protect him. He would, though, for all Neil couldn't find the words to explain that right now. I know what a corpse looks like, he said instead. You won't find her. They're too good at hiding bodies. Suddenly, the painkillers didn't feel like they were working quite so well. He ached. Browning must have picked up something from his tone, because he said, I'm going to see if I can find someone to look you over now that you're awake. There's an officer at the door. Neil wasn't sure if that was a threat or not. He made a noise of assent and listened as Browning stood and left. Once the door had clicked shut, he let out a long sigh. It didn't seem to matter how long it had been now. Years. Or maybe it just seemed so much longer in the wake of the last few days. Either way, it had been a long, long time. But here and now, he finally had a chance to make sure that everyone knew exactly what had happened to his mother. Your father is dead. He's dead, and you're alive. He had no intention of falling asleep again, but it happened anyway, with that mantra circling inside his head. That and, you are alive. You are going home. Neil woke to voices, half familiar and getting louder, dissolving into clattering and someone shouting, Hey! His eyes shot open and he made it halfway upright before the ivy in his elbow stopped him. Disoriented, he watched for a second without comprehension as Browning strode to the door, his hand at his waist. His gun. His voice rough, Neil yelped, No! The door opened so hard it nearly hit Browning, and someone in black darted through. Browning was fast. Wymack was faster. He reached out and forced the Fed's hand up, where he'd been turning the gun on the fastest of all of them, Andrew, who was suddenly at Neil's side. It had been less than 48 hours since they'd seen one another, face to face in a situation kind of like this one. It felt like lifetimes. Who are you? Browning snarled, suddenly looking like a proper threat rather than a rumpled cop in a suit as he wrenched himself from Wemack's grip. Andrew had a hand on Neil's chest and leaned over him like he meant to shield his with his own body. Leave them, Neil snapped, half torn between looking at Andrew and meeting Browning's gaze. They're fine, they're... Be quiet, Andrew told him, and Neil abruptly closed his mouth. We spoke on the phone, Wymack said into the ensuing quiet. I'm David Wymack. That's Andrew Minyard Urgoli. You can't just force your way in here, Browning said, though he holstered his gun and waved away the cop from outside the door, who still had a hold on Wymack's other arm. That guy is out there to keep Wozninski safe from the same kind of people who took him in the first place. You're lucky neither of you got shot. You're the one who called me, Wymack responded, utterly unruffled. If you didn't expect me to show up, you shouldn't have told me where Neil was. I didn't, Browning snapped. Didn't you? Wymack responded, with a hint of a smirk. Then maybe you shouldn't have called from a landline. These days, you can search those on the internet and find out the corresponding address. Haven't you heard? Neil thought that Browning might need to find a new dentist, thanks to the way he was grinding his teeth. I wouldn't congratulate yourself just yet, unless you were hoping to end up in handcuffs after all. Both of you. That was aimed at Andrew as well, Not that he seemed to care. Even with the threat of the gun gone, none of the tension had left Andrew's body. Neil, silent, drank in the sight of him. He had bruised black and blue across his cheek where he'd been hit, the color leaching into the hollow of his eye and jaw. "Yesterday didn't teach you to be scared of guns, obviously," Neil said, because someone had to say something. "Don't make me repeat myself," Andrew replied, voice low. His fingers paused a breath from Neil's neck, and Neil nodded when he realized what Andrew wanted. He hooked one under the dressing that had been reapplied there and unstuck it, barely pausing at Neil's wince when it pulled. He hadn't been anywhere near a mirror, but he knew it looked bad. Wymack swore under his breath at the sight of it, which was confirmation, even when Andrew's expression didn't shift. Andrew reached for his hand next. Neil stopped him, fingers to fingers in the barest, lightest touch, before he could remove that bandaging too. He said, I can't. He didn't want to say, don't, but he needed to. He thought that must have shown in his voice, because Andrew looked away from his hand, obviously misshapen, even swathed in ectoplast, to his face. This close, the bruise on Andrew's face looked worse than it did from a distance. Neil wondered if his cheekbone was fractured under the bloom of purple-blue where Jackson had hit him. Andrew's knuckles were bruised and grazed in places, the thumb on his right hand swollen. Those marks were a sign of life and of hard-won freedom, but Neil, sitting quietly with Andrew's hand still on his chest holding him down, was acutely aware that he was the reason they were there at all. Looking at him here and now was doing to Neil what hearing his voice over the phone hadn't managed. All those fissures he'd hastily plastered over were making reappearances, like he was a house at the epicenter of an earthquake. He'd been shaking for hours now. This was him breaking into pieces at last, throat burning on words he wouldn't let free. "I'm sorry." "Did it work?" Andrew asked, interrupting something he would never want to hear from Neil anyway. It wasn't please, but apologies weren't any sweeter. Especially when Neil was mostly sorry for putting Andrew on the finest edge of his control and then pushing him over. It took Neil a moment to remember what Andrew was even talking about. Their conversation, him tentatively saying he would explain later. Browning, his frown registering his tone, said, "Did what work?" "Yes," Neil told Andrew, without sparing him a glance. He hadn't come this far to slip up now. His deal with Ichiro still felt as tentative as spider silk. "Then you can do better than try," Andrew said. "Yes," Neil said. That was the best he'd been able to promise then, but "yes" to Andrew always felt better on his tongue. "As long as there's still somewhere for me to come back to?" Andrew had given his answer, and he rarely repeated himself. That was fine, because the question wasn't really aimed at him. Neil threw Wymack a quick glance, there, and then away. He might not fully understand their conversation, but he knew the both of them. He could guess. "If the question is, can you come back to the Foxes, then the answer is yes," he said. "But coach," he began to argue, before really thinking about it, even though the last thing he wanted was any answer other than the one Wymack had given him. "But what? But you're in danger? But you're dangerous? But you have a big mouth, a serious attitude, and a chip the size of Everest on your shoulder?" Wymack said. "Do you think I didn't realize all of that the moment we met? You're a fox. All of that goes with the territory. The foxhole court is where you belong." Neil blinked at him, and wondered if he'd ever heard a more accurate descriptor of himself out of someone else's mouth. "I want to speak with you," Browning interjected, speaking to Wymack. "About letting someone who presents a real and obvious danger to your team stay, when both they and he would be safer if he kept away." Neil didn't flinch, bolstered by Wymack's words, and the level look in his eyes that echoed their last conversation in his office back at the Foxhole Court. "I don't own you, and I respect your freedom to make your own choices, because I know you haven't been afforded that in the past. But you are a fox." "Well, those two aren't going anywhere," Wymack said, gesturing to Neil and Andrew. "Let's step outside and talk." Browning, lip twisted, looked long and hard at Andrew's back, before gesturing to Wymack to leave the room. Neil couldn't help flicking a worried glance to the door as it closed, and Andrew didn't miss it. "Do you think the cop is somehow going to convince Coach you're too problematic, after all?" he asked, finally adjusting from his rigid stance. He hitched his hip up on the edge of the bed, lifting his hand away from Neil's chest and using it to balance on the mattress. He was no further away, and not much more relaxed, but he no longer looked like he would turn and cut someone's throat at any moment. "I don't want Browning to tell him anything before I get a chance to explain," Neil said. "I owe all of you an explanation. About my father and everything else."
"You don't owe any of us anything," Andrew corrected. "Not anymore."
"I'm not back yet," Neil pointed out. They were a long way from Palmetto right now, and hours of talking away from even starting the trip home.
"You will be."
That sounded like a threat, but it wasn't aimed at Neil.
"What happened to your hand?"
"A psycho with a sharp knife." Neil swallowed heavily. "Think I can still play without that finger?" The joke came out dead on his tongue, and sounded nothing like the genuine question earlier. It wasn't one. He knew he could, even if it meant hours and hours of practice to regain what he'd lost in a few seconds to Lola. Andrew's hand lifted to Neil's face, his thumb smudging over the key tattoo on his cheekbone. He said,
"You know I don't give a fuck about that."
To a man who'd poured years and months into Exe, and who had for such a long time defined himself by his skills on the court, that dismissal shouldn't have been a comfort. But Neil was comforted, because he wasn't Nathaniel, the half-broken raven, anymore. He had more than that, starting with this man and ending with the people that he could trust waiting for him back home. A home, one that wasn't a glorified cage in black and red. He wasn't number three anymore. He didn't belong to Rico, he belonged to himself. And he was going to keep the promise he'd made to the Raven King at the Christmas banquet. For the first time since he'd left Evermore, he wholeheartedly believed that. Chapter 46. It was surprisingly simple to arrange for a man to be discharged from the hospital, even one in that state. Neil, as ever, was the only real complication. He took one look at the blacked-out windows of the SUV the feds wanted him in and balked. He was 5'3 in a sweater with the hood up, the gash on his jaw barely visible at this angle, looking like he'd just crawled his way out of hell, and a bunch of cops couldn't get him to move an inch.
"Let us drive him," Wimack suggested, before they could move on to threats and give Andrew an excuse to hurt them. "Special Agent Browning could ride with us if you think we're going to try and run off with him."
Browning's eyes narrowed, but he thoughtfully agreed. Andrew took the keys from his pocket and threw them to Wimack. He'd been the one to drive them north, on Wimack's suggestion. The man was afraid of nothing, apparently. He hadn't grabbed for the overhead handle once, even in the first hour before the familiar rhythm of driving had restored fragments of Andrew's control. Wimack clicked the locks and climbed into the driver's seat, and Browning took the passenger seat without looking back at them. The rest of them, Neil's guards and Browning's henchmen, the suits with guns, climbed into the SUV and pulled out. Andrew looked to Neil. There was something fixed in his expression. Not quite fear, but not quite anything else. He looked vulnerable, in a way unrelated to his bruised face and wounds. Andrew hated it. He asked, "Are you planning on walking back to South Carolina?"
"No," Neil informed him.
He did at least sound steady. It was a delicately constructed lie that was just waiting to fall apart.
"Hey, guess how they got me out here?"
"No," Andrew mimicked him. He didn't need to guess to know the answer was a variation on, "not a way that I liked."
"Get in the car. I don't have all day."
Neil got in the car. When he fumbled buckling his seatbelt with his bandage-swathed right hand, Andrew reached over and did it for him. His fingers felt too strong for the job, more inclined to break something than fix anything. There was no switch in his head to be flicked, one that would transition him from the man who'd pointed a gun at Jackson Plank and said, "I'd like to,"
with only truth in his voice. Back to the one who'd traced Neil's poem in the court lounge. The one who'd said yes. The one who could let Neil's whole hand brush his now. A silent question. There was no switch because they were the same man. Andrew, all steel and sorrow, was capable of allowing Neil to hold him, palm to trembling palm between them, until the tremors eased too. "We've arranged a hotel for you two tonight," Browning said to Wymac up front. "Nathaniel will have to stay on site." On site, in this podunk city in Virginia, meant the local police department, and, at best, meant sleeping in an interrogation room. Andrew didn't move, but Wymac flicked him a glance in the rearview mirror anyway. "We'll wait," he suggested. "No need to organize anything. I'm sure we've all slept in worse situations." "It wasn't a suggestion," Browning snapped. "Either you stay at a hotel or you stay in a cell." "That threat's getting tired," Andrew commented. "Are you going to follow through anytime soon?" Neil, who'd been staring out of the car window, said without turning, "Andrew stays or I'm not saying anything." Browning's ears were going red. "This isn't some kind of bargain, isn't it?" Neil finally looked over. His hand had gone entirely steady, and his eyes were ice. "Are you sure about that?" His expression said, "Is this the hill you want to die on?" After a long moment, Browning's answer turned out to be no. Wise. The Fed might not be good at threats, but Neil was. Andrew had no doubt that if he'd been split up from them both, the FBI would have had a truly uncooperative witness to deal with. Wymac pulled up in front of the main door of the police department, between patrol cars, but didn't get out. He snagged the hem of Andrew's shirt through the open window as he walked past, making him step closer to the idling car. "Call me when you're done. I'll pick you up," he said, and then let go. He watched Andrew join Neil on the sidewalk and then pulled out. "This way," Browning said, leading them into the building. Andrew set off the metal detector in the door, but no one bothered to search him. More fool them. Neil kept his face averted, as though that would somehow make him unrecognizable, but Andrew was too busy watching to do the same. The building was full of cops and feds alike. He wondered if the locals had resisted being partly taken over because of the location of one troublesome witness. Browning opened a door off the side of a hallway and ushered them inside. It looked like an office, though it had no windows at all. They were still taking security seriously, judging by that and the fact that another cop pulled a chair up outside the door. Neil took one of the chairs, Andrew another. Browning, on the other side of the desk, produced a pad of notepaper and a recorder. "The sooner we start, the sooner we get this over with," he said, clicking his pen. "You ask the questions, I'll answer them," Neil replied, with just the barest taste of humor. Browning had a lot of questions. Neil answered all of them. His voice was level and considering, and did not waver even as he recounted all of the things that would make other people weep. It was obvious why Browning had been so intent on protecting Neil, listening to it. As evidence went, it was damning. To Andrew, it was clear that Nathan Wisniewski had made a terrible mistake in selling his only son to Tetsuji, rather than killing him outright. Whether he'd thought it was fear or some kind of misguided loyalty that would keep Neil silent wasn't clear, but either way, Neil knew far, far too much. Browning was interested in Neil's father, but Neil didn't hold back when it came to Tetsuji and Riko either. The shift in Browning's expression at the first mention of their names was faint but notable. His brow furrowed, and he jotted down a few notes. They pushed on into the evening with only a brief break for dinner, but Neil started fading early, and Browning seemed to recognize that. He stood and gathered his notes, informing Neil he'd see him in the morning, and that someone called Davis would be in shortly to set them up for the night. Then he left. As soon as the door closed behind them, Neil blew out a long sigh. God. That vulnerability again, but different this time, because he was showing Andrew this chink in his finely held control on purpose. Or, if not on purpose, because he knew that he could relax right now without it being held against him. There was a brisk knock at the door, and then it opened to admit a broad-shouldered woman with a stretcher bed under each arm. She made them stand out of the way while she snapped the legs into position and set them catty-corner to one another in the clear spaces around the desk and the chairs. Someone else came in, with blankets slung over his shoulder and a medical kit. "I'm Officer Davis. Apparently you have wounds that need cleaning." "Put the kit there," Andra instructed, the first thing he'd said in hours. He pointed at the desk, and Davis obeyed, and then left, clicking the door closed behind him. "Not really a part of your skill set," Neil noted. He walked over to the desk and perched on the edge of it next to the bag, his gaze on Andrew's face. That wasn't entirely true. One didn't live a life like his without learning some first aid. But Andrew could see his point. He ignored it in favor of stepping closer, unzipping the kit and pulling out what he'd need. The people from the hospital had left Neil's throat uncovered, but they'd given clear instructions that all of his wounds needed to be cleaned daily for at least a few days, particularly his hand. Neil hadn't looked like he'd been listening, caught up in his impatience to get out and get things over with, but Andrew had. There were plenty of disinfectant wipes in the top of the kit. Andrew ripped open the foil packet of one and stared at Neil until he obligingly tilted his jaw to allow him access to the stitched gash there. Andrew wiped over the line of where it traveled diagonally across the underside of Neil's chin and up over his jaw into the softer flesh of his cheek. It would scar, unavoidably, but it looked clean enough that there was little chance of Neil losing a chunk of his face to infection. He didn't hiss or flinch at the sting. "Back," Andrew commanded. Neil slid off the edge of the desk and turned, putting them much too close to one another. When he fumbled getting his shirt off, pausing with it hooked over his elbows and shoulders, Andrew pulled it the rest of the way off. It was a mess underneath, but he knew Neil had never been all that pretty under his clothes from the few times he'd been forced into changing with the rest of the team. The new additions were lurid, scabbing where they were too shallow to stitch, the skin between red raw with some kind of friction burn. He was red and swollen and ugly from nape to mid-spine, but that didn't obscure the distinct shape of the W the marks formed together. "Not very original," Andrew said, opening a new wipe and starting it on one side. Neil laughed, low and hoarse, which meant that he knew. "She called herself an artist," he commented. Head bowed. "It's a statement piece, I guess. But it's not like she thought I was going to live to see it scar." "They got her, too," Andrew said. Browning had mentioned that when he'd called later to say that they had Neil, that he'd made contact with them, which had been the first whisper to Andrew that whatever he'd been planning to do had worked. If it hadn't, the Fed would have been calling to say they'd found a body. It just hadn't been until Neil's confirmation from his hospital bed that Andrew had really believed it was true. "Yeah," Neil replied, accepting Andrew's assistance with putting his shirt back on. "Yeah, they did." He sounded like he didn't quite believe it. He sounded like he wanted to very badly. When he turned around again, there was something dark and distant in his eyes that didn't falter when Andrew started to unwind the bandages from his hand. Nothing could be ignored forever. Neil looked down to his hand once it was uncovered, flexing it into a fist in a way that definitely wasn't part of the recommended physio program. It was clean, healthy, already probably healing underneath the stitches. But looking at it, there was no denying that Neil was short a finger, taken off low by the knuckle. It left him with a distinctly unbalanced-looking hand, especially when he extended his remaining fingers and thumbs to the point where they were strained. It had to hurt. Neil didn't make a sound. He'd gone dead white, sweat breaking out over his brow. He looked fixated and unable to look away, the crawl of shock wiping his expression. It was emotional, not physical. But that didn't mean he wouldn't get sick over it. His breathing was too fast, and getting faster. Andrew reached over with his free hand, pushing Neil's face until he turned it away. Stop that. Neil made a sound through his teeth, a complaint cut off into a keen by his gritted jaw. His breathing jolted, but picked up at the same rate, so quick it was bound to be starving his brain of oxygen. Andrew's hand was still at Neil's cheek. He used it to grip Neil's chin with only a modicum of care for the wound there, turning him so he couldn't look anywhere but at Andrew's face. Neil, stop. It took a moment, but the action earned him Neil's full attention. His expression flickered back to something more familiar. There was recognition there, like he'd been expecting someone else but found Andrew. Like he'd gone elsewhere in his head and got lost. Andrew had no intention of letting him disappear. He said, talk. He looked down to continue what he was doing, but he could still feel Neil's focus on his tilted head. Neil swallowed convulsively. About what? He rasped. As if Andrew cared. Whatever. He released his hold on Neil's face, sure now his mind wouldn't wander again, and needing the hand to finish his task. It probably hurt, but it was as good a reminder of being alive as any. Not just for Neil, either. You didn't bring Kevin with you? Neil asked. Andrew should have expected that one. I said talk, not ask questions. Then you should have specified. There was a taste of dry amusement in his voice. He wanted to be there to welcome your rescued bird, Andrew answered. That was Kevin, all torn between anxious fear and nobility, the most ridiculous waste of emotions Andrew had ever cared to see in a human being. Have you heard anything from them? Neil asked. No. Dan's panic when she'd discovered both Bea and Renee had turned their phones off had been lessened only by Reynolds' cool dismissal of her concerns. Neil hummed. I'm surprised you didn't drag him along anyway. He asked. That wasn't something Andrew thought he was capable of. They were all dogs learning new tricks, apparently. Wouldn't have thought I'd live to see the day, Neil said. That isn't saying much. Neil should have been long dead at this point. That he was still alive was a testament to how far blind, stupid, determined commitment could get you. Hey, Neil said. When Andrew met his eyes again, he was the man Andrew remembered from the night in the lounge of the court. You can touch me. They were close, eye to eye with Neil slumped down on the desk. When he tilted his chin in invitation, Andrew kissed him firm enough to bruise. One more wasn't going to mean anything, when they were both black and blue all over. The feds had drained Neil dry by lunch the next day, and set them free with only a minor attempt at convincing Neil it would be better to sign on to witness protection. His answer was predictably rude. Browning didn't seem surprised. Wymack was waiting for them in the parking lot like he'd never left. Neil's pause before climbing into the car was so brief it was almost unnoticeable. He managed to do up his own seatbelt this time. It was a long, silent drive back to Palmetto through the afternoon and into the night. Neil spent most of it asleep. He'd been restless last night, and though the car couldn't be more comfortable, it was certainly quieter than the office had been. More secure, too. Wymack didn't ask any questions with the unspoken understanding that Andrew wouldn't answer them anyway. The stories were all Neil's to tell, and he wasn't in a chatty mood. With the unerring instinct of sleeping passengers everywhere, Neil woke up properly 5 minutes away from campus. Where are we going? Straight to Abby's to get you checked out, Wymack explained, making the turn towards her house. They weren't the only ones. Besides Abby's Honda was Bee's gray Ford. Its hood was cool to the touch under Andrew's fingers as he brushed past it. Neil eyed it with trepidation that was presumably aimed at its former passenger. I warned them, Wymack said over his shoulder on the way to the front door. Warned them about what? Neil asked. Wymack paused purely to shoot him a dry look. That you're a mess. I think they knew that already, Andrew commented, ignoring Neil's huff as he overtook him. Renee was waiting in the hall when the door opened, in the shadow. It didn't do her much good with her bright hair, but the dark matched her expression. She looked more like the girl who went by Natalie Shields. "Expecting trouble?" Andrew asked, but her expression had already shifted as she recognized them, from dangerous to her particular brand of warm and gentle. "Oh, Neil," she said, hand to her mouth. Abby put her head around the door at that, with Bea at her back, which answered Andrew's question anyway. They were definitely expecting someone other than their teammates. "Let him sit down, at least," Wimax suggested gruffly, like Neil hadn't just been sitting down for hours straight. Maybe he just didn't want to have this reunion in the hallway. They moved into the lounge, but there was no time for sentiment once they arrived. Kevin was sitting on the couch, his body half turned away. In the far doorway stood Jean Moreau. His pale eyes darted straight to Neil, and for a long moment their expressions matched. Unlike Kevin, whose gaze had gone straight to Neil's hand, Jean didn't look away from his face. "Nathaniel," he said in his heavy, accented voice. "Jean," Neil said, with the same kind of weight. There was wariness in his tone, bleeding into the relief. "Glad to see you're still alive." He looked remarkably spry for a man who'd required a midnight rescue, not even bruised. Or, at least, not where Andrew could see. He didn't think Rico's restraint was very good, but Jean was also the best backliner the Ravens had. Presumably, that meant not breaking him completely. "Likewise," Jean replied. "Rico's mood improved over the weekend. Your loss was my gain, I suppose." Andrew bristled. His voice was soft when he said, "I'd be careful. The balance can always be shifted." Jean met his gaze straight on. There was a taste of the resignation and fear that Andrew remembered from his appearance at the first banquet, overlaid with blankness. Shock, perhaps. Maybe something more familiar than that, to Andrew in particular. "It's fine," Neil said, shooting Andrew a quelling look that he felt more than saw. Jean looked away first. "I don't understand how I am still here," he told Neil. "They had no right to take me from the nest." "I hope you tried telling them that," Neil replied, throwing Renee a look. "You're right and wrong. They didn't then. They used information I gave them to ensure they could. They don't now, either, but that's only because you belong to the main branch now. Kevin, too." Everyone in the room blinked. Jean and Kevin had both gone white, but Kevin was the one to say, "That's impossible." The curled corner of Neil's mouth said, "Have you met me?" "No, it isn't. You aren't free. None of us are. But you are now part of a deal with Ichiro Moriyama that gives you the same freedoms I've had this past year. And all you have to do is play Exe and then part with a little cash." "Ichiro? Not Kengo?" That was Kevin, his expression twisted halfway between fear and hope. "Kengo's still in hospital. But the heir to the throne has big dreams for his reign, apparently. He wants to start early," Neil replied. Jean had sunk against the doorframe like his knees were wobbling. Neil's expression softened at the sight. He said, "You aren't free, but it feels like it, right?" Jean drew in a short breath, blew it out. "You were slated for death. What could you possibly have had to bargain with?" Neil's eyes flickered between B, Wimac, and Abby. He shrugged. "That's not the important part. The important part is that you never have to go back there. Or if you do, it'll be wearing a different team's colors." The shape of Jean's shoulders shifted, softening. Maybe he'd thought Neil arranged all of this as an elaborate prank, and that he'd been planning on sending Jean straight back to Rico. It sounded like something that would be fun to a Raven, even with Andrew's limited experience of them. "I don't understand why he let you live," Kevin asked, his brow furrowed. "He didn't have much of a choice," Neil replied. "When I saw how things might go wrong with the main branch, I made sure to find information on them to use as leverage." "Then he definitely should have killed you." Andrew had to agree with that. "How stupid do you think I am?" Neil said. "I'm not the only one who knows it. I divided the information up and encoded it and gave my uncle the key in case anything happened to me." On a few pieces of paper, Andrew was willing to bet. Ones that he'd entrusted to Renee and to Andrew, with the understanding that even in death, Neil would bring the Moriyama Empire crumbling around their ears. Especially in death. As plans went, it was the kind Andrew could approve of. There was something to be said for careful planning and all-consuming spite. The front door slammed. Someone yelled, "Neil!" and the lounge was suddenly full of foxes. Andrew had to wonder who had called them all here. Renee, probably. They were smart enough to stop at a reasonable distance, but not to refrain from all speaking at once, a mix of anger and relief and happiness. There were plenty of people willing to fuss over Neil, if he let them. It was easy enough for Andrew to escape the crush and slip out onto the back porch. He leaned his elbow on the railing and lit a cigarette. He wasn't sure how long he'd been out there when the door behind him opened. He'd been expecting Renee, but it was Neil who stepped out into the cooling late afternoon air. "Wondered where you went," he said in a low voice. There was something expectant on his face when Andrew threw him a glance. "I'm surprised you managed to escape," Andrew commented. He was more surprised Boyd and Dan hadn't followed him out here, with the rest of the foxes close behind. Neil hadn't had a chance yet to recognize just how desperate they'd been over his disappearance, but they'd no doubt made their relief over his return obvious. "I told them I was going to go lie down for a bit," Neil said. "I don't think they believed me, but they pretended to." He was smiling just slightly, in a way that melted the chill blue of his eyes into something else entirely. Even battered and half-broken, he was real and solid and standing right here. Andrew looked at him for a long moment, while Neil looked back. Andrew said, "You gave me that piece of paper a while ago." It had been the day Andrew got out of East Haven, Neil's request of Andrew in fulfillment of their deal. It wasn't that long, but it felt like a lifetime had passed between then and now. It also hadn't seemed like much of a favor in repayment for Kevin's protection. Andrew hadn't known then that weeks earlier, Neil had bought Andrew's safety in Proust's death. He hadn't known that it was Neil's life insurance written on that paper. It didn't matter, because he would have upheld his promise to keep it safe were it a bit of used tissue. He, after all, had owed Neil. Except it did matter, because it was the two of them, and Neil shouldn't have trusted Andrew like that. "A while ago" meant we were nothing to each other then. But that wasn't true, because Andrew and Neil had been orbiting one another from the moment they met. "Yes," Neil replied, and didn't look away. The end. Thanks for listening. Chapter 47. Epilogue. The Things We've Done. "Okay," Kevin said. His voice echoed back off the walls and the confines of the court. With just the two of them under the lights, it always felt different, but right now the familiarity was overwhelming Neil. It had been weeks since he'd set foot in here, and right now it felt like something holy. He'd missed that feeling. It was like being 10 years old again, marveling at Castle Evermore's size and the brilliance of the players. He'd lost the purity of that feeling a long time ago, but every now and then he got a taste of it. Neil had a racket in each hand, one heavy and one light. He tested each in his right hand, feeling the extra force his missing finger put on his thumb and index finger mid-swing. It had hurt, it had taken time to become accustomed, and it was going to be hell on his aim. But here and now, he thought that it was going to be okay. Putting aside the lighter racket, he said, "Get on with it." Kevin rolled his eyes as he set out the equipment for the first Raven drill. Once done, he took his racket from where it leaned against the wall. In his left hand, just like old times. "That's going to hurt in the morning," Neil observed, gesturing for Kevin to go first. He knocked 5 out of the 6 balls off of the cones. The last dropped through the expediency of him hitting the cone itself, so the ball rolled off. Not a bad showing for a man who'd been training with his other hand for months. By his expression, all victory and obsession with the challenge, Kevin knew it. Neil was far, far more wayward. He took down the first cone, but his balance was out, and his second, third, and fourth shots went astray. He had to pause before the 5th and 6th to shake out the jolting pain in his wrist, but those two did fall. His strength was the same, his aim was shot, but he could fix that. "You're going to have to do better than that," Kevin noted as he jogged down to reset the cones. Neil scooped up another ball from the bucket at his feet and threw. It bounced off the back of Kevin's helmet with pin-perfect accuracy, making him whirl around. "Hey!" Neil, teeth gritted with the pain of it, but halfway to grinning, said, "You were saying?" Kevin's fall from grace, and really, he needed to stop thinking of it that way, had begun with murmurs in the wrong ears, ones that everyone else would have rejoiced at. Kevin, who'd had the number 2 beaten into him long before he'd had it inked permanently on his face, hadn't heard them until it was too late. "Day is the better player. Let him step out of the shadows. Your perfect court isn't so perfect." Rico's shadow stretched so long that it blotted out the light. Kevin had known that the perfect court wasn't perfect every time he looked at Jean and Neil, but it was another thing entirely to confront the truth he held like a tiny star in his chest. He couldn't bear to squash it out, for all he needed to. "I'm better." He figured it didn't matter. He thought Rico would shrug it off, even if he did hear it. He hadn't realized that deep inside, Rico was harboring a sneaking dash of insecurity that seized hold when those rumors did reach him. Rico had never believed that Kevin might be better. Kevin knew that now with startling clarity. He just couldn't bear that other people might believe it, and see him as something other than the perfect son of Exe, the perfect king. It seemed fitting that his downfall, too, would start with whispers. Someone hadn't kept silent. Perhaps someone high up in the school, maybe someone from inside the nest. But either way, everyone knew that the last of Rico's disciples had defected. And not just that, there were mutterings of blood and violence, of scars and obsession and abuse at every level within the Ravens. Quiet ones, but they were out there. They were true. Kevin held that thought inside him too, but he couldn't stop being afraid. He'd turned to Wymack and told him first what he wanted to do. Jean's disappearance was louder in the media than anything else, besides Neil's still mysterious injuries, and everyone was desperate to know where he'd gone. Kevin had the means to distract them, and he meant to do so. Jean deserved that much. Kevin hadn't been able to do anything else for him, but he could do that. Then he'd said, "Do you know of any good tattoo artists?" Now, sick to his stomach and coated in sweat, Kevin pulled off his helmet and gave every member of the press in the room a good view of his new tattoo. He'd thought long and hard about what meant enough to him that it could lend him strength when he looked in the mirror, because he was tired of feeling it sapped from him every time he saw the number 2 there instead. In the end, it was easy. And if the black chessboard queen had earned him Neil's quiet approval and a new considering light in Andrew's eyes, so much the better. "You aren't free, but it feels like it, right?" Neil's words had been for Jean, but they applied to Kevin too, and he was right. This tentative release felt just like freedom. And this moment right here felt like victory and like vindication. They'd taken to the court tonight with Neil on the bench, Dan dark-eyed and determined in his place. It should have been impossible to win against the Catamounts and make it to the third round for the first time ever without him, but the word impossible had never meant much to the Foxes. Neil had bolted onto the court with Nikki and Allison at the final buzzer, catching Kevin with one arm around his shoulders and tugging him down. Eyes alight, he'd said, "Hey, I was right." "What?" Kevin asked, tugging his helmet off. His feet were numb and his arms were killing him, but the scoreboard read 6-5 to the Foxes, and that last goal was all his. "You're going to be better than they ever could have made you," Neil said, right before Matt pulled him away and Dan collided with Kevin in his place. Kevin had been frozen solid for several moments, those words echoing in his head. Not just, "I'm better," but the idea that there was room for growth and change and improvement outside of the nest, with the Foxes, and even after that. The journalists were professional enough that their questions started with the game, though they shifted soon enough to questions about Neil and his injury. They didn't know anything yet, but that would change soon enough. Whispers would become shouts for comments in no time, and then it would be Rico's name they were saying in place of Neil's. As it was, Kevin told them Neil would return to the starting lineup before the season was out, like it was a given that they were going to go all the way to the final round. It must be very rewarding to make it this far with the Foxes. Your presence has made a huge difference in the results of a team that was once famed for being completely fractured, someone said off to the side. What do you think has turned things around for them? I can't take credit for all of that. The Foxes were on their way up before I came south, and while Neil and I might have introduced some new concepts and abilities to the line, that would mean nothing without the capabilities of the rest of the players and the coaching of my father. He watched that sink in across the assembled faces, his heart beating quick in his throat. There was a momentary silence, as they seemed to struggle with what to say to that. Eventually, one of them just said, "Your father?" "My father," Kevin repeated, with a twist of a grin that he'd learned from overexposure to Neil Wisniewski. Aaron caught up with Neil in the otherwise empty stairwell, the clatter of his footsteps catching Neil's attention. His expression was predictably sour, but not openly angry, which was a change. They hadn't spoken since Neil had come back. Looking at him now, Neil could still feel the sting of the words, "raven-trained whore," but he knew there was no point in waiting for an apology that was never going to happen. He also knew that something had changed between the twins during his absence, because they'd gone on since as though nothing had happened. He just hadn't cared enough to ask yet. "We're swapping rooms," Aaron said. He dropped something on the landing at Neil's feet that clattered on the metal. It took Neil a moment to recognize it as a key, rather than anything more sinister, and another to catch up with what Aaron had actually said. "Excuse me?" he asked. "You and I are swapping rooms," Aaron repeated slowly, as though Neil were either hard of hearing or exceptionally stupid. "And why would we do that, exactly?" Neil was quite fond of his quiet suite with just Matt for company, and while sharing with Andrew might have its upsides, he didn't feel the same about rooming with Kevin and Nikki. "Because I won't bring Caitlin anywhere near Andrew," Aaron replied. Neil raised an eyebrow. "Didn't you have a deal about that?" "Yeah, and he broke it when he tried to break my face over you," Aaron said. "We made a new one, not that it's any of your business." "Anything that involves me is my business," Neil pointed out, rather than forcefully banging Aaron's head against the wall. He could see all of the ways that Aaron could manipulate Andrew to get what he wanted because, despite his mistakes, he'd still seen something that night at SUA's court that he could use as a weapon. Aaron stepped a little closer, probably because he read that temptation from Neil's face. "I don't know what he sees in you, you know that? But I don't care as long as I get what I want out of it." "What? So you give up on your crusade to get rid of me and you get Caitlin?" Neil asked, the idea of it becoming solid in his mind. "Hope you ran that by her first." She didn't seem like the kind of woman who could be owned, for all she was a different breed from the Foxes. But Aaron's half-smug face said Caitlin was already on board with this plan. "Nice of you to take her back. She said you were an asshole," Neil commented into the silence, just to see the flicker of anger over Aaron's face. "No more so than my brother," he said, which vividly reminded Neil of Andrew saying to Aaron, "I guess that's one of the ways we're the same." He'd been more right than he'd anticipated, perhaps. They both had, by the way Aaron had said, "then prove it," with utter certainty that Andrew wouldn't be able to prove Neil didn't mean anything to him. Against his better judgment, Neil felt a faint buzz of amusement in his chest. When he'd first challenged Aaron over Andrew in the aftermath of Drake, this really hadn't been how he expected it all to play out. "She and I have equally bad taste, then," he said. And then before Aaron could snarl, "Fine, we'll swap rooms. Do you think you can wait until tonight, or is that too long?" Aaron threw him a deadly look as he pushed past him on the landing and rattled down the next flight of stairs. Neil called after him, "I'll take that as a yes." Once the sound of footsteps had faded, he bent down and picked up the key from the ground. With it tight in his fingers, he couldn't resist a smile. Jeremy Knox was all grin and casual good cheer in his red and yellow hoodie when Neil and Kevin picked him up from the airport. He waved openly to them from a distance, practically jogging across the last few yards. Kevin Day. The two of them shook hands, but Jeremy used his grip to drag Kevin closer into a back-slapping one-armed hug. Kevin looked wide-eyed, but not displeased by the gesture, though there was no softness in his spine. Neil felt the corner of his mouth quirk up at the sight. "And you go by Neil now, is that right?" Jeremy asked as he let Kevin go. At Neil's nod, he smiled and offered his hand as he said, "Neil, it's good to see you again." Because Neil hadn't always been confined to the nest on game nights, not even away games. He remembered vividly the few times he'd been allowed to watch the Ravens play. Semi-finals or finals games, usually, because Tatsuji strongly believed him watching poor playing would be a bad influence. He remembered Jeremy talking to Kevin, receiving an offer from Rico, turning him down in a way so good-natured, even Rico barely grumbled afterward. He had family in California he didn't want to leave, apparently. Not even for a shot with the best college XE team in the country. Neil wasn't sure he'd ever met someone like Jeremy in his life, and he equally wasn't sure he and his team were any kind of fit for Jean. It had been Kevin's suggestion. Neil had only encouraged Jean to meet with Jeremy because he'd seen the Trojans on the court with him at the helm. He figured there had to be something behind the sunny personality to have gotten them so far. "Congrats on your season," Neil said, taking his pro-offered hand for a firm shake. The Trojans had decimated their opponents in the first third-round game in the evens bracket. Then he jerked his head towards the doors. "Cars this way." It was starting to feel like proper summer weather outside. Jeremy and Kevin chatted Exie on the way to the car, seemingly unbothered by Neil's silence. Jeremy also made no mention of any more dangerous topics, which had to be intentional. There was no easy way to talk about the game without mentioning the Ravens. Especially not right now, with the team in disarray and the championship trophy firmly installed in the Trojans' court. Neil was the one to drive them back in Andrew's car. It wasn't as nice as the last, but Neil had plans for that, which involved a generous cash donation from his extended family. Unfortunately, that required a little less scrutiny by law enforcement. It also required Andrew's agreement, which would perhaps be more difficult to achieve. They went directly to Abby's, where Jean was still staying. Kevin would have kept him close, but Jean wasn't a PSU athlete and had no intention of becoming one, so had no place in the tower. Neil was grateful for that. He and Jean were broken in the same ways, different from Kevin, and it was too difficult to look at him without feeling like nothing had changed. Everything had changed. From a distance far greater than anything Rico would approve of, Neil was starting to see it in Jean, too. That included the chill glance he spared Jeremy when they were introduced in Abby's kitchen. There was no indication of the fact that Jean had bowled Jeremy into the floor three separate times the last time the Ravens had played the Trojans, nor that Jeremy had got past Jean an equal number of times to score. They shook hands like it was their very first meeting. That gesture seemed to hit the limit of Jean's courtesy, though. "Really?" he asked in French, his focus on Kevin. "This is what you consider suitable?" Neil wouldn't have thought it was possible, but Jeremy's smile got wider. He said in the same language, "Do you not agree with his assessment?" When Kevin and Jean both stared at him, he shrugged. "I might be planning on going pro after I graduate, but I like my linguistics major." "Ah," Kevin said. His ears looked slightly pink, but Jean still looked unimpressed. "I don't think that I am a suitable fit for your team," he informed Jeremy in English, his tone sharp. He was always more interesting when he could be convinced to strike head-on. Usually it took more needling than someone like Jeremy should have been capable of. "Why don't you come to California and find out?" Jeremy replied. It sounded like a dare, and he and Jean held gazes for a long moment. "And then we'll see whether you're suitable for us or not." The implication that Jean might not make the cut hung in the air between them. Kevin looked caught between being offended and unable to say so to someone he so admired. Jean's disinterest was transforming into something else entirely. "So you only act nice," Neil couldn't resist commenting. "I wouldn't say act, but I am a pragmatist," Jeremy replied. "I just save that for situations other than interviews. I guess you wouldn't know about that." "I guess I wouldn't," Neil agreed. Jeremy looked at him for a long moment, grin still in place underneath shrewd eyes. "Are you looking for a change of pace as well?" because we might have a space for a striker of your caliber on the line. He wasn't saying it to be kind. For all he was known for it, he was still a Class 1 captain whose aim was to win. Taking Jean was hardly charity, and offering Neil a place wasn't, either. That was fine. Neither of them trusted charity anyway. You can't just poach Fox players, Kevin protested, though it was fairly good-natured. He and Jean both watched Neil as well, waiting for his answer. Neil had a choice. He'd already chosen. No thanks, he said. I'm staying. I'm happy for you, Renee said, right before she blocked Andrew's punch with her forearm. They circled again, each low and easy on the balls of their feet. Anyone else would have said that as an attempt at distraction, but for Renee, the words were genuine. As far as she was concerned, that she had time to think about that just meant that Andrew wasn't making her work hard enough tonight. I hope you aren't expecting the same sentiment from me, Andrew replied. Truthfully, he didn't care much about Renee's relationships, though he considered Reynolds to be an odd fit, and Moreau even more so. He'd observed Reynolds and her clumsy attempts at needling Moreau in French, and Moreau's quiet watchfulness with both of them, and seen merely a multitude of ways that it could fuck up, and very few where it wouldn't. Renee laughed, her voice husky with exertion. That's fine, Andrew. Watch your foot. He pulled himself back into alignment where his left foot had been drifting out, and unevenly distributing his weight. Renee had been waiting for the adjustment. As soon as he was square, she hit him with a flurry of punches that forced him back a step. I'm pleased for both of you, she continued, while Andrew resigned himself to staying on the back foot for now. Any attempt to regain ground was going to end up with him on the floor. The two of you are good for each other. I've thought that for a long while. Andrew's attempt to stop her talking by aiming a punch just past her guard ended with her grabbing his wrist and throwing him over her hip. He landed flat on his back on the grungy carpet, most of his breath leaving him with the collision. Renee's face appeared in his range of vision. She was still smiling. Sorry. When he didn't acknowledge her, she dropped down to sit cross-legged at his side. Is everything all right? He shot her a flat look, which made her smile grow. Then, a more serious light in her eyes, she said, It's been an interesting few weeks. Phil Higgins had called Andrew in person to pass on that everything he'd spent the last few months working on was about to go public. Neil had told him everything, or as close to it as he ever would, and what he hadn't Andrew had managed to piece together. Andrew had hung up on Higgins before he'd been able to do anything as stupid as apologize. 2 days later, the entire thing had gone public. Enrico had been arrested. He'd gotten out on bail, of course. He might have preferred a cell to the firestorm of the media, though. With professional contracts scrapped and the support of his school stripped, the King of Ravens was now a sportsman in name only. With their captain gone, along with most of their best players, the Ravens had suffered a close but humiliating loss to the Lions in their second third-round game. The Foxes had beaten Binghamton and were looking likely to advance to the next death match with their current points total. Whether they would be facing off with the Ravens in the semifinals, presuming they made it, which the rest of the team seemed sure about, looked increasingly uncertain. Yes, Andrew agreed. Interesting. That was one word for it. When Neil opened the door for Wymack, he already knew why he was there. The presence of Theodora Moldani at his back was the surprising part, and the part that made Neil put his arm across the door. Coach, he said, though he was looking at Thea. It's not a great time. Kevin's choice to vegetate in the morning with the local sports channel on in the background had backfired on him this morning. The leading news item had been Rico's suicide. He'd come into the bedroom and demanded of Neil, Did you know this was going to happen? Yes, and so did you. Neil had replied. He'd received a message from Ichiro last night that had just said, It's done. He might have had a more direct warning, but Kevin had known it was coming since before Christmas. If he'd chosen to ignore it since then, that was typical of Kevin and his own problem. Kevin had gotten into bed and hadn't moved since, but Neil wasn't worried about him. He'd seen enough changes in Kevin over the last few weeks to know that he would be fine. That didn't make Thea's presence a good thing, though. Neil heard rustling from behind him as Andrew moved towards the door, another stubborn sentinel. "Nathaniel," Thea said. She was cooler and more calculating than Kevin could ever hope to be, but Neil had trained with her on the court since he was a child and knew that underneath that was one of the most ferocious tempers of anyone he'd met. She was what Dan would have been as a raven, warmth beaten from her and everything else amplified. They'd never really gotten on very well. Neil was unsurprised when she'd continued, "Let me in or I'll knock you over." "Kevin isn't interested in talking to you right now," Andrew said from over Neil's shoulder, a gentle threat. "Go away, Muldani." "I came out here to talk to him, and I'm not leaving until I do," Thea replied, anger bubbling in her voice already. Her raven number pendant hung free from her shirt, as though she'd been toying with it. She'd never cared much for Rico, and never played under his captaincy, but that didn't mean she wasn't perturbed by his sudden death after everything else that had come to light over the last few months. "Kevin isn't interested in talking to you right now," Andrew repeated. He didn't look at Thea like she was a real threat. Neil suspected if it weren't for his own reluctance, Andrew would have let her go without complaint. Then again, he always had been an instigator of sorts. "Thea, go through," Wimax said, tiring of the standoff. "He'll be in the bedroom. You two, move it." He stepped inside first, allowing Thea inside before he closed the door. She shot Andrew and Neil both a haughty look before disappearing down the hallway. Nikki came out a second later, squawking, caught sight of the three of them standing in the main room, and then diverted to the kitchen with wide eyes and a pinched mouth. Meanwhile, Wimac was looking at Neil. "What happened to, if we want to do something, it has to be on the court because that's all he cares about?" "Stakes got raised," Neil replied. Wimac was smart enough to have seen this coming, even without an explicit warning. He'd probably known even before Neil had. He looked like he had a multitude of questions, but he seemed to recognize that Neil wouldn't or couldn't answer most of them. Instead, he said, "Are you satisfied?" That was a good question, and it had an easy answer. Neil smiled and felt for a second like his father's son. Nathaniel Wisnitsky twice had surprised Ichiro Murayama, which was twice more than he ever permitted. He should have known better. Like his father before him, he trusted Nathan as a valuable and effective tool, and Kengo had never had a single reason to doubt the butcher's loyalty. But some mixing of the blood between Wisnitsky and the Hatfords, a family known for being capricious, had meant Nathaniel was willful and unpredictable. The first time they'd met, the first time Nathaniel had surprised him with his warnings, Ichiro's father had said, once he'd left, "That's a dog you only trust when it's wearing a choke chain and you're holding the leash." Ichiro hadn't quite believed him then, looking at the boy who was all too eager to put in his lot with far more powerful men than his brother over a sport. That slip had given Nathaniel the leverage to earn himself a second deal, one that he'd fulfilled his end of admirably. Ichiro's brother was dead. Whatever reputation he'd had in the fraught world of professional sports people and celebrities and tatters around him. His grasping uncle was similarly shamed. Ichiro was adjusting himself to the title of Lord after effectively acting as such for the last several months, and his new wife and he would soon be extending the main branch of the family. The throne was a comfortable place to be seated. But a rebellious child had reminded him of how easily a castle could be brought down. Nathaniel was a threat, and Ichiro couldn't trust him. But he wore a choke chain. There were people he cared about. That was something that could be used against him far too easily, if someone was that way inclined. Ichiro didn't mean to be surprised a third time. Chapter 48. Epilogue. They don't own us. 1 year later. Andrew woke to the jolting of the mattress, tensing in a way that he couldn't control. He made the same jerky grab he always made when he startled into consciousness, feeling for a weapon between the mattress and the wall. Then clear thought filtered through. "You're in Colombia. That's Neil Wisnitsky. It's the 27th of January. There's no knife. You don't need it. You're safe." He'd been telling himself that last thing for a long time, and he still barely believed it most days. but that didn't mean he'd stopped. 27th of January. This year, the Foxes had ridden their winning streak all the way through the first round of spring championships, including Thursday night's home game, and the media was already whispering about an improvement on last year's results. Playing at PSU meant it was easy to leave the others behind and drive up here for what was, essentially, an anniversary. It had been a long year. Neil, with his grocery list of PTSD symptoms and the same brittle but unbroken stubbornness, had taken an unsurprising amount of time to admit that he was struggling to bear up under the weight of everything. No one could last like that forever, though. Andrew, who'd hit that point and shattered a long time ago, had been waiting for it. And he'd stayed right there, in a way that he never should have been able to, while Neil proceeded to start putting himself back together into some kind of patchwork creature of a man. Neil was all stitches and scars now, but he was still alive, and he was still here. They both were. That meant something. Neil liked to remind Andrew of that every time he thought Andrew might have forgotten. Andrew leveled himself out of bed, padding barefoot across the bedroom floor. His armbands he left in the bedside drawer. He'd relocated them from their usual position on top of the dresser when Neil had grabbed for them one night and frightened himself badly. For all he claimed to be unafraid and unbothered by what he could do to people, Neil disproved himself sometimes. The house was quiet and dim in the early morning light, which was barely enough to see by. It wasn't a feat of deduction to find Neil. He'd curbed his running habit after numerous lectures from the others on the dangers of running in the dark, and he also had the bathroom light on. Andrew had forced the shame of struggling out of Neil somewhere around the third month, which meant that he didn't flinch when Andrew drew the shower curtain back. He was cross-legged on the tub floor right over the drain, the water falling straight onto his head. He was also still wearing exactly what he'd worn to bed last night, all of it now plastered to his skin. "Neil," Andrew said. "Really?" "You can drop the exasperated act," Neil rasped without opening his eyes. "It's not like you didn't know this was going to happen. That's why you dragged me out here to start with." "Cute kidnapping reference," Andrew replied, reaching in to turn the water from freezing to warm. Neil shuddered, though whether that was because of the change in temperature or a relic of his nightmare was impossible to tell. He was right. That was exactly why Andrew had brought them out here. He'd watched Neil all week, tentative in a way he never was, how he'd caught his breath on the court on Thursday night like his control was slipping, and known that Neil was walking the blade-fine edge of bad memories, known that he was going to lose his footing. Andrew had also known he wasn't going to fall far. Stupider people might have called that faith, but they didn't know Neil Wasninski. "Just give it a minute," Neil said, through his teeth. There was a hard pinch between his brows, and his fingers were clenched so tightly on his knees that he was bound to bruise. "Shall I count?" "A hypothetical minute," Neil replied. Another shudder rolled through him, slow and all-encompassing. The placement of Neil's hands meant there were no real safe zones for Andrew to touch, so he waited until he saw a tentative pinking of Neil's exposed skin before he turned the shower off. The cessation of noise made the bathroom seem very quiet in the instant afterward. Neil didn't move an inch. "Look at me," Andrew said, low. There was no room for argument in his tone. Neil opened his eyes, brilliantly blue against the shades of white and water in the harsh-lit bathroom. He said, "I'm always looking at you." He wasn't wrong. Andrew felt Neil's eyes on him more often than he liked, but there was nothing covetous in his expression. He dared and demanded more than Andrew had ever given anyone permission to, but he knew what to do when he was told no. "It's been a year," Neil said, blinking water from his eyelashes. "I'm tired of this." Andrew didn't have a reply to that, except harsh realism, and Neil didn't want an answer anyway. He was stating the obvious, and it was echoed in his drawn, dark-shadowed face. But Neil had no desire or need for sympathy. He wanted understanding, and Andrew could give him that. "There'll be more years." When you'd stared death in the face, there was something vast and buoying in knowing just how long a human life was. Even Andrew understood that, with a series of delicate promises knitting themselves together in his mind. One that started with, "We'll still be here tomorrow." Neil's expression flickered, and then resolved into something more his usual. His fingers flexed and released themselves, his right one touching Andrew's where it curled around the lip of the tub. They weren't shaking anymore. "Am I getting out, or are you getting in?" he asked, with the faintest shadow of a smile. Andrew answered that by leaving the room. It wasn't long before Neil, dry and dressed, joined him in the kitchen and accepted the mug of coffee Andrew had poured for him. They went out to the porch so Andrew could smoke and Neil could shake off the very last of his fear in the crisp air. It was still early morning, quiet outside, the first rays of sun just barely stretching over the front lawn. That meant it was easy to hear the soft, "Thanks," Neil pressed directly into Andrew's hoodie at his shoulder, warm and easier than it had any right to be. "We'll still be here tomorrow." That sounded like a promise, and they were good at keeping promises. The end. Thanks for listening.